I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. How could it happen? How could an 11, 13, and 15-year-old buy three airline tickets with cash, their babysitting money, at the Southwest counter at Jacksonville International Airport in Florida, then cruise through security with no IDs and fly to Nashville, Tennessee alone? After landing, they called home and, with local police involvement, flew back to Jacksonville that evening. But no one would even know about this if their families hadn't called news outlets. Erin Hawley is a reporter with First Coast News. That's the combined ABC-NBC affiliate in Jacksonville, Florida. And, Erin, we know this all happened on Tuesday, and the story's just starting to unfold. But it's your news outlet that the parents called?
That's right.
And so what did they tell you? First of all, you spoke with the kids. What were they doing?
Well, they just wanted to fly. Bridget is 15. She's the oldest that went with them. And she told me that she just wanted to fly somewhere.
Well,
so she saved up some money and apparently had asked her parents, hey, if I save up this money, can we go somewhere? Her parents said no. So she decided she was going to go herself.
Called a cab, went to the airport. Now, this has, you know, whimsical aspects to it. It has horrifying aspects to it. Something could have happened to them. But it also has airline security questions. How did they do this without an ID? Did they say anyone asked them?
No one asked them. I talked to all three kids, and all three told me that not once did anyone ask them for an ID.
Not even on the security line?
No. And I did talk to TSA, and they've said that, you know, children under 18 are not required to have an ID. So no one, you know, Southwest and TSA, neither did anything wrong in this.
Well, now that that is a well-known fact, people might want to be reexamining that. But what do the parents say? These are, we understand, two families.
Mm-hmm. The oldest and youngest, 15-year-old and 11-year-old, are brother and sister. And then the other 13-year-old boy, I spoke with his family quite a bit yesterday. His dad was just kind of in disbelief. That's how I would describe it. He was very calm, but just couldn't believe that this had happened. I spoke with his mother today, and she is literally sick over the whole thing. She said that she hasn't been to work. She's been, I mean, just physically sick over this, that her kid was able to get on a plane without her permission and wind up in another state.
Did the kids say, you know, okay, they weren't asked for their IDs, but were they asked at all about where their parents were?
No, they told me that all they had to do was sign a piece of paper with their parents' names and phone numbers, and they were told that was in case the flight was delayed. That was all they were asked about their parents.
Well, we know public officials did get involved on the second leg when one of the kids, when they landed in Nashville, called a parent. The parents called local police, who then ushered them through the system to bring them home. But did that trigger any kind of alarm with Southwest Airlines, with the airport? I mean, those were local police.
No. They said they had no problems getting back.
Well, what questions are people asking today?
I think the biggest question is, if nothing was done wrong according to these policies, should they be taking another look at the policies? You know, Bobby's father told me, you know, what if my son had been a 13-year-old terrorist? We don't want to scare people, but it's something that you have to think about.
Well, not just a 13-year-old terrorist, but a child who's being forced by someone to do something.
Sure.
And meanwhile, what are the parents saying is going to happen to the kids? How are they going to go forward?
Well, I don't think anybody is really being punished. Bobby had his phone taken away. That was how the initial request was asked. Bridget texted Bobby. We actually have the text message. Do you want to go to Tennessee today? All three kids were very casual about the whole thing. They said, you know, it was quick and easy, and we really didn't mean to upset our parents, but they didn't seem too upset about any of it.
I think
it was kind of an adventure for all of them.
I think someone will be keeping a closer eye on that babysitting fund.
I think so. Yeah. But, you know, it's every parent's worst nightmare. I mean, who doesn't let their kids go play with the neighbors for a couple hours during the day? These parents just thought their kids were down the street playing with the neighbors.
Erin Hawley, a reporter with First Coast News, the ABC-NBC combined affiliate in Jacksonville, Florida. Erin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, one wonders what kind of conversations those kids had on their flight. Our next guest has made onboard conversations part of her research. She's a professor of African American studies, and when flying, people like to ask her about race. It's been part of the national dialogue as well, that fired Agriculture Department official who was accused of being racist when, in fact, she was not. Her words were taken out of context. Then there's conservative radio host Laura Schlesinger. This week, a black listener called to ask for guidance on racist comments she'd heard from neighbors. Schlesinger challenged her to define racist. The caller said, well, how about the N-word? Here's a part of Schlesinger's response, which we've bleeped.
Black guys use it all the time. Turn on HBO, listen to a black comic, and all you hear is
The caller was stunned.
I hope everybody heard it. So what
they did, and I'll say it again. N-er is what you hear on HBO. Why don't you let me finish a sentence?
Well, later in the hour, Schlesinger took herself off the air and has since apologized. Talking about race, it can be inflammatory, which is why Mary Beth Gassman likes to have conversations in private, on airplanes. She's an associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. You can read her blog post, Traveling as a Professor, for the Chronicle of Higher Education at our website, hereandnow.org. Her new book is The History of U.S. Higher Education. She joins us now. And Mary Beth, people also perhaps become more engaged with you because...
I'm white.
There you go. Is that rare for there to be white professors of black culture?
Not really. There are actually quite a few people now who study African-American history or African-American studies who happen to be white or Latino or Asian. I mean, it's becoming more popular, but I think in general, people tend to be African-American or black and doing that kind of work.
Well, in fact, some of the people who post comments to your blogs have questions about that. You know, what's a white person doing? We want to address that. But meanwhile, how does being white and being on a plane affect the way people talk to you?
Inevitably, when they find out I'm a professor, they'll say, well, what do you teach about or what do you do research on? And I'll say, I do research related to African-American history and mainly African-Americans in higher education. And so they'll kind of give me that, well, that's interesting. Now, how did you get interested in that? And I'm very open about answering those questions because I probably would ask the same question. And so if they're white, they tend to ask me questions that maybe they've been wanting to ask for a long time but might be uncomfortable asking in front of someone who's African-American or another race.
Just go through some of the questions you've been asked. And we want to start with one that seemed like a doozy to us. Why is having a black president empowering to young black people? Did someone really ask you that?
Yes. And I think one of the reasons why people feel comfortable asking me is because it's anonymous. I don't know their name. They're probably never going to see me again. And sometimes we'll exchange names, but it doesn't always happen. And so the man who asked me that, once he found out what I did, he said, you know, there's a question I've really been wondering about, and I'm wondering if you can answer it. And I said, okay, fine. And he asked me if having President Obama, a black man, as president, was empowering to young black men. He said, I don't get that. And I said, well, I want you to think about who were your mentors when you were young. Who were the people that you looked up to? And he told me all of them were white men. And I said, so think about what it's like for a young African-American boy to look up and see this African-American man as president. We had a great discussion.
Well, and I guess this is what you're saying. That's sort of fascinating that someone would not know that, you know, not know that to see somebody who looks like you might signal to you that you might have that possibility, you know, that opportunity. But this guy wasn't pulling your leg. He really didn't understand, right? And so this is where I'm wondering if this does become research for you.
I don't think he was pulling my leg, and I think he genuinely wanted to know. I mean, he did push back a little bit, which I think is very interesting because pushback helps me to have better arguments, and sometimes I rethink my arguments. But I will say that in many ways, it does become research because it jogs my memory. It makes me think of things in my research. It makes me think of future research projects. It makes me think of questions that I can ask in my research. And it makes me think differently, and that's important.
Well, and you hear what people really think, something that might not be politically correct to say in other situations. Give us some other questions that you're asked.
I do a lot of work related to historically black colleges, and so there are 105 of those out of our huge, you know, number of almost 4,000 colleges and universities. And most people, when they'll ask specifically what I do, when I tell them that, they don't know what a historically black college is. And they might not even know the more familiar ones, like a Spelman, a Morehouse, or a Howard. So that would be most white people. Most African Americans do. And so they will ask me, well, what do you mean we have historically black colleges that educate African Americans? How can that be? They're really baffled that we have these institutions. And so I try to explain to them that we have historically white institutions as well. institutions that were created to educate whites. I get that question a lot. They're baffled by the fact that we have these institutions and they're not aware of it.
Well, another question, why are African-American college grad rates lower than that of whites? And, you know, some of these questions reveal stereotypes. Some of them expose real problems, real factual problems and class divides in America. So how do you approach questions like that?
Well, that question is really interesting because the truth is that the rates are lower, but there are lots of factors involved. And so one of the things that I try to talk about are the societal issues involved. So overall, and these are generalizations, but overall, African Americans have less access to higher quality primary and secondary education. So that plays a part. African Americans have less access to wealth. Of course, that plays a part in how you perform in school. You have less access to resources. And so that plays a part. It's a really complex issue. And so I will engage the person in a conversation about all of those different factors. And I like to listen to what they have to say, too. I want to know, well, why do you think that this might be the case? And what can we do about it? That's usually what we talk about.
But, you know, I want to talk about some of the responses to your answers. Mm-hmm. Because, well, as you know, in the comments on your blog, a lot of people applaud you, but also people take you to task. Question, you know, whether you're just being politically correct, you come off as kind of a PC white do-gooder, according to them, for instance, in answering the question about graduation rates. You talk about there not being equal education or positive examples of high-achieving African-Americans. And one blogger said, why not talk about some of the problems in the black culture, marriage rates, out-of-wedlock births? Why are you afraid of looking at the hard stuff?
Well, there are a couple of things there. I'm an expert on higher education, so I'm not going to claim to be an expert on some of those other things. And one of the things I learned a long time ago as a professor is that you stick to what you know. In terms of the whole do-gooder thing, I really don't like politically correct discussions, and I prefer that people be very open about how they feel about race. And I think the best thing that we can do is to talk openly. It was interesting when I read the blog comments, I noticed that people said, oh, you know, you must be telling them to be politically correct. And actually, I've never really done that. What I've done is listened, and I've challenged a little, and I've been challenged quite a bit. And then I think both of us have learned something, because it's through talking that you learn, not chastising or jumping on someone.
Well, but at least one occasion you didn't engage, and we want to ask you about that after we take a break. That's University of Pennsylvania professor Mary Beth Gassman. She is white and studies African-American history, specifically education, and has found that people like to engage her in conversations about race when she flies. She blogs for the Chronicle of Higher Education and has written about questions she's asked. You can read that at our website, hereandnow.org. When we come back, as we said, we'll pick up with an instance where she took offense at a question. Some people said, why? And when we come back, the answer to the question she gets a lot, why is she so interested in this field? Also, coming up later, a group of wealthy Americans who are pushing to be taxed more. That's later. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the questions our guest, University of Pennsylvania professor Mary Beth Gassman, gets asked by seatmates on airplanes. She's a professor of African American studies, and she's white, which surprises a lot of people, but she says it may also help them to ask questions they wouldn't otherwise. And she's been telling us that she likes the give and take and learns as much as she teaches. But Mary Beth, there was one question you write in your blog that somebody asked you. It was, why are young black men more promiscuous than other men? And you found that offensive and explained to your seatmate why it was a conversation stopper. You do that through a note. But people on your blog took you to task for this, saying, why not engage in that dialogue? One wrote, maybe this is a way to talk about real problems like out-of-wedlock births, which we mentioned earlier. But you were just offended by the question.
I was. I was offended by the question because I do think the question is inherently racist. And it was asked in a way where I knew where he was coming from. I could see it all over his face. And so,
And where did you think he was coming from?
he wanted to engage me in a discussion that was disparaging. I'm not going to engage in that discussion. I'll engage in a discussion where we talk intelligently about these kinds of things, but not in a disparaging way. I told him that I was offended by it, and we sat there and we were fine, but I wrote him a long letter, and it wasn't mean and it wasn't chastising. It was just, you know, comments like that, this is what they result in. And I handed it to him, and, you know, he could have thrown it away. That's okay.
Well, and I think that, again, some people applauded that, but other people wrote, let's talk about those tough questions.
Well, I think you can talk about them, but, you know, you also have to know yourself and know what sets you off and what you're comfortable with. And so I decided to write him a note instead. And, you know, I felt fine about that.
What do black seatmates tell you? The questions that you write about seem to be mostly white.
Okay, so of course there are going to be more whites on the plane because whites make up the majority of the country. But I have sat next to a lot of African-Americans or Latinos. By and large, blacks tend to be very accepting of my doing this work. I mean, I don't think I'm the end-all, be-all of this historical work that I do on African-Americans. I do it because I really love it. I also think in doing work on African-Americans, I'm doing work on American culture and American history because they're part of American culture and American history. And so I think they tend to be really receptive, and the conversations tend to be very pleasant.
And I'm thinking of one guy that you met in first class who was, you know, really decked out in a hip-hop outfit.
Mm-hmm. You know, after about 20 minutes, he told me that from time to time, what he likes to do is dress not in a suit, because he's actually fairly well off, but dress in, you know, kind of casual urban clothing and see how he's treated. And he told me about the number of times flight attendants have asked him if he's in the wrong seat.
Yeah. Well, but then there's one of the blog posters. You know, you may have the great conversations on the plane, but some of the blog posters question whether a white woman should be researching African-Americans, or asked if it was a question of privilege, and where are the privileged African-American professors researching Caucasian-Americans, and I hope we hear from them, actually. But meantime, why are you interested in this?
I was given a book to read in graduate school called The Education of Blacks in the South by James Anderson, and that book just fundamentally changed my perspective on American history. At that point, I had only been told about blacks as being victims. And so in reading that book, it changed my perspective. And I started to become very interested in, well, how have blacks shaped their own lives? And what kind of leadership have they demonstrated? And what kind of action have they taken? The other thing is that I think that it's really important to have blacks studying white issues. And I think it's important to have whites studying black issues. And, you know, when I was younger, I think I used to have a little bit more insecurity about that. But I feel very comfortable. When I go to sleep at night, I feel good about what I do.
Well, and by the way, we're thinking of Nell Irvin Painter, a black writer who just wrote a history of white people. She's out of Princeton. Well, and you also identify with at least one aspect of some of the African-American experience in this country.
Yeah, I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I grew up very, very poor. I wouldn't necessarily compare that to being African-American because not all African Americans are poor, and there are privileges to being white. But what I would say is that I did come from a low income background and
Head Start kid.
I was a Head Start kid, and you know, that's how I got a good meal every day. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I love learning, and probably one of the reasons why I became a professor.
Well, and you take this thinking abroad as well. I'd love to have heard the conversations when you traveled with 23 grad students on a plane to South Africa. You got to see a divide between how your black and how your white students viewed South Africa when they got there and from South Africa viewed home.
Yes. I've been doing that for 9 years. And so over the time period, even though it's not official, I've been sort of watching them. And so it's interesting because my white students tend to be able to notice systemic racism. So racism in housing, education, employment, when we're abroad in South Africa. And they can easily point the finger. They can't see that in their own country. They have a really hard time seeing that. Normally, it's the black students on the trip that point that out to them. Hey, we have this in our own country. Why can't you see it?
Well, it's funny that it's South Africa because there's that great quote from Robert Kennedy He delivered it at the University of Cape Town, South Africa, in 1966.
Yeah, he began by describing a country that had intense racial division and racial segregation. And
settled by the Dutch.
Yes, absolutely. And everyone thought that he was talking about South Africa, but in the end, he revealed that he was talking about the United States. And that's because, in many ways, we have very similar histories. It's just that theirs is a little bit more recent, and I think we tend to forget that.
That's Mary Beth Gassman, associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. We've been talking to her about conversations about race that she finds herself getting into on airplanes. You can read her blog about all of this, Traveling as a Professor. She writes it for the Chronicle of Higher Education at our website, hereandnow.org. Mary Beth, Professor Gassman, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And by the way, we'll have that 1966 Robert Kennedy speech in Cape Town at our website. He defines a land settled by the Dutch, a land that subdued natives, and then he ends.
A land which defined itself on a hostile frontier. A land which was once the importer of slaves and now must struggle to wipe out the last traces of that form of bondage. I refer, of course, to the United States of America.
Back after the news, here and now. Tomorrow is Independence Day in Pakistan. India's is the following day, marking the days in 1947 that both countries received independence from British rule. But the celebration in Pakistan this year will be low-key, as that country deals with horrific floods. Water levels continue to rise on the already swollen Indus River, and doctors say malaria, diarrhea, skin diseases are growing threats. The BBC's Mike Wooldridge reports.
The helicopter carrying bags of food supplies, bottled water, and the chief minister of Punjab is taking off from a town in the south of his province, Rahimia Khan, on the latest of his personal relief missions. The pilot, Colonel Safdar Hussain, was one of the most decorated helicopter pilots in the Pakistan Army. With the worst hit area below us, he sums up what he's seen flying day in, day out during this aid operation.
As far as these people are concerned, I think they have gone 50 years behind. They have lost their houses, they have lost their cattle, they have lost their crops. It's human destruction, and I think the world community needs to react immediately.
At the moment, we're flying between the River Indus, which has swollen to 18 miles in width at this point. It almost looks like the sea in front of me. And other flood over to the right-hand side, which is actually water that's come down from mountains to the west of here. So there's a double problem in this area, which makes people feel that it will take even longer now for the waters to go away.
We put down briefly at one of the tented relief camps for flood victims. The chief minister, Shahbaz Sharif, weighs into the crowd.
Aapki dukh takleef itni zyada hai ki jiska hadd o hisab nahi, magar ye aapki dukh takleef nahi, ye meri dukh takleef hai.
The problems and the grief are not just yours, he tells the people, they're mine also. He promises transparency in the relief operation and that only the deserving will get food. He is, of course, only too well aware of the widespread criticism here of politicians in general over their response to the disaster and over the inadequacy of flood control measures. When I speak to Shahbaz Sharif after we've returned to base, he does nothing to disguise the challenge now facing Punjab, known as the food basket of Pakistan.
We are the engine of growth in this country. Therefore, not only we need huge funds for relief and rescue work, but also for rehabilitation, also for repairing our irrigation system, our barrages, our roads, our bridges, and communication system, and also our sewage system, which is all washed away.
One effect of the disrupted communications is being felt in the food markets. Fewer vegetables and fruits are reaching them because of blocked roads.
This is the market right in the heart of the town of Rahimia Khan, and I'm in the part where they sell vegetables and fruits with a trader who's just been telling us that he is having to pay a lot more to buy in the vegetables because there's difficulty getting them from the flooded areas, from the areas where they're produced. But he says he can't pass that extra on to the consumers because the state government regulates the prices. So he's complaining he wants to be able to charge more to consumers. But there are also stories at the moment of consumers, of shoppers, having to pay much higher prices as well. And there's no doubt at all that this is another area where we're seeing an effect of the flooding. It's emerging now in various aspects of the economy of this province, and much of what's produced here goes off to feed people in other parts of the country. And it sounds as if those supplies are being curtailed at the moment as well. So while all the relief operations go on, while there's still people to be rescued, there's growing worries now about other aspects of life here, and in particular on the economic front.
The BBC's World Affairs correspondent Mike Wooldridge in Pakistan. Well, up next, the case for a tax increase on wealthy Americans, and it's a case being made by wealthy Americans in 30 seconds, here and now. When Congress returns next month, the hot potato will be the Bush tax cuts set to expire at the end of this year. Republicans and some Democrats want the cuts left in place, less taxes for everyone. President Obama wants to keep them in place for everyone, but individuals making over $200,000 and families making over $250,000. And a group of people, some well into that tax bracket, agree. They're led by Mike Lapham. He's a paper mill heir, but also director of the Responsible Wealth Project at United for a Fair Economy. Responsible wealth is made up of business people and wealthy individuals who want their taxes increased in part because they say it's better for business. Some advocates point to the roaring 1950s when the rich were taxed at 91%. By contrast, in the years leading up to the Great Depression, they were only taxed at 25%. Well, Mike Lapham joins us in the studio. And Mike, you know, tax us more? Do people say, what are you, nuts?
That's the great part about this project is, you know, I get to work with wealthy people who are saying, I get it. I have more than other people. There may have been luck involved. There's often a lot of public investment involved in my success as, you know, being a millionaire or billionaire in some cases. But I get it that I should be paying more. So I have a great job because I get to work with those folks.
And you agree with the president. Let the cuts expire for the very wealthy. Explain, first of all, what that means in percentages, you know, what we're talking about.
The top rate was cut from 39.6 to 36, and the next one was cut from 36 to 33. We think both of those should be reinstated for people in the top 5%.
Well, and some would go further and say add a new top income tax bracket higher than that 39.6% for people who are paid more than $2 million per year. Would you agree with that?
I think it makes sense to look at that. And I would also look at raising taxes on people at a slightly lower income than just the top 2%, which is the $250,000 figure.
Well, now let's remind ourselves, for the average American, these tax cuts only produce maybe a few hundred dollars a year, for very important for a lot of families. Right. But for the very wealthy, these cuts produce hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
And people arguing to keep the cuts say that that money on those top tiers, since it's so much, is the best cut to keep because that extra money is the money that can stimulate the economy, not several hundred dollars. You say what?
Right. A lot of people like to say, oh, we have to give wealthy people tax cuts because they're the engine of the economy. It's just not true. There's no correlation. If you look at during Clinton's years, we had higher tax rates, had one of the best economic years in a long time. Under Bush, we had lower tax rates and one of the worst economic growth periods.
Okay, a couple questions. What about the argument made by many, including Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat from Nebraska, who says that eliminating the tax cuts will mean small business people won't hire? And we hear this all the time, that especially the tax on families making more than $250,000 that would apply to, you know, small business owners, that this will really hurt small businesses.
The reality is that most small businesses have income like under $100,000. Raising taxes on people above $250,000 is not really going to affect small businesses.
And what about the estate tax? It was removed this year after Republicans waged a very successful campaign against it. They changed the name of it to the death tax, said people would lose family farms You say what?
So we have actually have a member up in Maine named Jim Amaral, who owns Borealis Breads, who recently wrote an op-ed saying that as a small business, he resents being used as one of the poster children for a repeal of the estate tax. He believes that it doesn't affect someone like him who owns a small business, and it's actually in his best interest to have a strong estate tax because that supports important programs. The reality of the estate tax is that it affects less than 0.25% of people who die every year. This year, we would have collected $25 billion from the estate tax, but there was no estate tax this year. When billionaire Dan Duncan died with an estate of $9 billion, there's $4 billion right there that the government didn't collect. So that's going to have to be collected from someone else.
You know, a lot of billionaires died this past year. Right. New York Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, Forbes estimated he was worth about $1.1 billion. Mary Janet Morse Cargill died. Her family founded Cargill Incorporated. Her net worth, about $1.6 billion. And there are liberal senators calling for estate tax reinstatement. Are you as well?
Absolutely. This should have been done. They had 10 years to take care of this. Right now, there's really three basic proposals out there. There's a Kyle proposal that raises the exemption and loses a lot of money. There's the sort of middle-of-the-road Obama and a new proposal by Senators Sanders and Harkin and Whitehouse that keeps the exemption level at 2009, like $3.5 million per person, $7 million per couple. That's a pretty good amount to be able to pass on to your heirs tax-free. We need a strong estate tax, and Congress needs to do it now.
Well, and what about before that happens? You've got this move by billionaires promising to give their money to charity. 40 billionaires signed up after Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, you know, sort of led this charge. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg signed on. A lot of people cheered. Your thoughts on that? I mean, you know, we don't need a tax. Let's get billionaires to voluntarily say they'll give their money to charity.
You know, there are certain things that charity is good for, can do, and then there are certain things that we need government to do. I think we do need both. I think there's a role for both. But if the message of this is let's have all the billionaires decide what they're going to do with their money and not give any of it to the government, then that's not a message that I would support or responsible wealth members would support. Part of the reason that we need a strong estate tax and need progressive taxes is because we do need to pay for these things that we can do together that we can't do individually. What I would really love to see some of them do is use their voices to say, we should be paying higher taxes. We should have a strong estate tax. I would love to see some of them give their money directly to the government. Just think of the symbolism of that.
Well, a little full disclosure here. I know you. Outside of the studio, I never knew you were an heir. It would not have occurred to me. You live in a beautiful but very modest home. You walk up. You have a tenant, I think.
No doorman.
No doorman. What do you say to people who say, well, you know, Mike Lapham, that's fine. If you want to wear a hair shirt, you know, if you have some sort of feelings of guilt, you know, having inherited money, that's your business. But, you know, my family worked for generations, and I want that second or third summer home. And you know what? I want to live right a little higher on the hog, and I just want to do that.
I think the message is, sure, I was lucky to have been born into a family where my great-grandfather founded a paper mill. But I think what sets apart responsible wealth members and maybe some of these billionaires who are taking this pledge is that they recognize that it was a combination of luck and public investment that made it possible for them to have that money. The employees of the paper mill that my family owned, you know, were mostly publicly educated. The roads that the trucks drive on, the legal protections, everything is a result of public investment. And responsible wealth members and others realize that they need to give something back to make it possible for other people to follow in their footsteps and continue to create that prosperity.
Mike, thanks.
My pleasure, Robin.
Legendary director Alfred Hitchcock would have been 111 today, and it's Friday the 13th. Coincidence? We don't think so. And Hitchcock's classic suspense film Psycho turns 50 this year. Who can forget Janet Leigh as Marion Crane, on the run with the $40,000 she stole from her employer? During a rainstorm, she stops at the Bates Motel and meets motel keeper and taxidermist Norman Bates, played, of course, by Anthony Perkins.
Dirty night.
Do you have a vacancy?
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. They moved away the highway.
Oh, I thought I'd gotten off the main road.
I knew you must have. Nobody ever stops here anymore unless they've done that.
Marion will, of course, come to deeply regret that she stopped at the Bates Motel, or at least that she took a shower there. But with films like Paranormal Activity or the Saw movies, 1 through 6, does Psycho still pack a punch? Let's ask our movie mavens, Boston Globe critic Ty Burr. Ty, nice to see you as always.
Thank you.
And here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
To get the answer, Renee, the question was prompted in part because we overheard you talking with senior producer Kathleen McKenna, whose 13-year-old son is desperate to see Psycho. You said what?
Absolutely.
Even though, didn't it traumatize you or a nephew or something?
It traumatized my godson. I was in charge of him for a weekend while his parents were away. I took him out to dinner, and then I rented Psycho and showed it to him.
So why not traumatize Kathleen's son, too?
Probably, but it's a great movie. And even though 15 years later, he's never let me live this down, he really enjoyed the film. He was probably about 13, 14 at the time, so I think the age is right.
Well, and Ty, you have written the book, by the way, on kids and film, mm-hmm. and we'll link listeners to that at hearandnow.org. But your daughters, what are your thoughts?
Actually, they are 13 and 15 now. So you know what? They're the right age. And my younger one is actually the bloodthirsty one. She's the one that loved Jimmy Cagney movies, that, you know, gangster movies. The older one's the weenie. So the younger one has been asking me for 5 years, when can I see Psycho? And so yesterday, actually, we sat down. They were really quite taken. They were very, you know, my hands were being gripped very tightly when the door to the bathroom opens. But they were really into it.
So that answers one question. Is it still relevant to kids? Because obviously we've got all these kids clamoring to see it. But does it still have the power to terrify if you're older or if you've seen it once? Let's remind people. It begins with a scene, very risque at the time, Janet Leigh having a lunchtime tryst at a seedy hotel.
You never did eat your lunch, did you?
I better get back to the office. These extended lunch hours give my boss excess acid.
Why don't you call your boss and tell him you're taking the rest of the afternoon off? Friday anyway, and hot.
What do I do with my free afternoon? Walk you to the airport?
Well, you could laze around here a while longer.
In its day, that was quite out there.
Oh, absolutely. The opening scene was very risque. And in fact, it was risque when I was watching it with my daughters, because it's a black and white movie. And they turned to me and said, when was this made?
Even now, 50 years later, it's a little shocking because it's just not something you're accustomed to seeing to open a film.
It also introduces the theme of voyeurism, which is all over the movie, because literally the camera has to sneak in under the shade to let us see what we're not supposed to see.
Kind of like a rear window effect, which, okay, so parents might want to remember that. People forget, you know, all of this. All we think about is the shower
oddly
scene.
Oddly enough, when I watched the film with my godson, I'd sort of forgotten about that scene. So I was actually a little uncomfortable watching that scene with him and found myself watching him to see how he would react. He looked vaguely embarrassed by watching it with me.
Not the American way. We're more concerned about the sex than the violence.
Right. Well, the movie had other firsts. It was the first time you ever saw a toilet flush on film. But continuing our storyline, Marion decides to abscond with money from her employer. She meets Norman. Doesn't meet Norman's mother, but overhears Norman asking his mother if he can invite Marion to have dinner at the house rather than, you know, serve her at the motel. Let's listen.
No, I tell you, no. I won't have you bringing strange young girls in for supper. By candlelight, I suppose, in the cheap erotic fashion of young men with cheap erotic minds.
Mother, please.
Okay, we're not giving anything away. We're not going to give any endings away. We're just letting that scene stand. Later, of course, Norman does serve Marion dinner, and they talk. Let's listen.
A hobby's supposed to pass the time, not fill it.
Is your time so empty?
No. Well, I run the office and tend the cabins and grounds and do little errands for my mother, the ones she allows I might be capable of doing.
Do you go out with friends?
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
It seems to me that hearing the beginning of the film, you know, you'd say, well, there's nothing really scary here till we get to the shower scene, which we're about to. But when you watch the film knowing the ending, like the second, third, or fourth viewing of it, that's pretty weird stuff.
Well, the first 30 to 45 minutes of the film are kind of a brilliant misdirection. It's sort of setting up this film in a way that you're not really clear where it's going to end up. And by the time you get to the end of the film, you almost forget where you began.
Right.
Because it almost, the film almost splits in two after the shower scene.
It's similar to what he did to Vertigo in a similar sense.
Absolutely.
And it's similar to what happens to Norman in his head, actually. But let's talk about that shower scene. We read that when Janet Leigh saw the final product, it terrified her so much, you know, she never took showers again. You know, everybody knows the sound. There's the sound.
It is really the first moment of modern horror movies. I think it's the first moment where we usher in the age of sensation and say goodbye to the age of sentiment in Hollywood film. That scene where the main character we've been following for 40 minutes is dispatched, says all bets are off.
Yeah, her sister comes to investigate, accompanied by Marion's lover, Sam. We saw him in the Afternoon Delight.
Impossibly beautiful John Gavin.
There. And there's also a private investigator played by Martin Balsam. And beyond that, we're not saying anything. But what does it say about any attitudes towards women, Renee, that she's dead-o so soon?
You know, not just that she dies early in the film, but it's also the sense of, if you watch the movie a certain way, that she's being punished for her actions up to that point. There's this hidden message that when you're naughty, you're made to pay for your sins.
I see what you're saying, and I agree that that's there, and that's typical of Hitchcock, who loved punishing his characters. But I also think the movie is surprisingly sympathetic toward Marion Crane as a character who's stuck in this man's world. I think the movie is, in a weird way, quite sympathetic to her isolation.
Right up to the moment when they murder her.
There you go.
But that's kind of the point. She's a victim.
But there is, I don't think you can quite get away from the sense that she is somehow being punished, even though she's even being punished for having the initiative to take the money to start this new life with her lover, which she never gets to start, of course, because she unfortunately takes a shower.
Well, okay, how does it hold up? You know, it's interesting. Today we seem to need to have people turn into bizarre, you know, werewolves.
I think one reason that Psycho was so effective, and I think remains so effective, at least especially was me as a kid when I saw it, was up to that point, I'd watched a ton of horror movies and it was all zombies and Frankenstein and Dracula. And suddenly, this wasn't a monster. This was a human being. And, you know, and you had to suddenly, at least for me as a child, contend with the fact that ordinary people can do horrific things to each other.
The horror genre has always really periodically gone back and rebooted itself. You'll get more and more arcane Baroque monsters, and then a movie will come along that's cheap, that's simple, that's basic. And Psycho is in that tradition. It was made cheaply with Hitchcock's TV crew. He shot in black and white. It was a real under-the-radar kind of thing, and it worked. And it still works because of that simplicity. It hasn't dated.
That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. We've also been speaking with Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham about Psycho. It turns 50 this year. Watch it again if you dare. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you,
Robin.